We are on page 886. We are on Pos Revi, in the middle of the page. The story up to now, after Moshe Rabbeinu counted the Jews, basically for the division of Eretz Yisrael, and he discusses, you do it with lottery and with seichel and all that stuff like we learned the last weeks. Tzlovchad's daughters came, and they said, we have a problem. Our father died, nothing to do with Korach, nothing to do with anybody else. Bottom line is, he didn't have any sons. So, what do we do? So Moshe Rabbeinu says, good point, let me ask God. Okay? So we discussed, there's one more thing that Rebbe explained, I'm going to just mention here. So we mentioned that why did Moshe Rabbeinu, first of all, Moshe Rabbeinu was punished because he said to the Jewish people, anything, the small things you guys deal with, the big things bring to me. So that was on Moshe Rabbeinu's level, was a level of haughtiness, 886. It was a level of haughtiness, and Hashem made him forget the Halach. Okay, that's one thing. Another thing it says, that this parsha should have been written to Moshe Rabbeinu. Tzlochot's daughters merited through the greatness, the righteousness, that Moshe Rabbeinu, instead of going it through him, it went through them. But the Rebbe explains an interesting thing over here. And he explains it a very important lesson. When the girls came to Moshe Rabbeinu, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu in Pasuk Gimel, he was not involved in the Korach fight. That's what they said. He died in his own sin. He was not involved in the Korach fight. And therefore, now you have to understand what's going on over here. Korach was a personal fight against Moshe Rabbeinu personally. Okay, who made you the Macha? You know, everybody's great. Why are you so great? When they came along with a statement that he did not participate in the Korach story, that created a certain influence on Moshe Rabbeinu for their benefit. Because they said, listen, he wasn't involved in the fight against you. Okay? That was what's called in English a little bit of bias on Moshe Rabbeinu's part. So the Rebbe says, you know what the Torah is teaching us over here? You could be Moshe Rabbeinu. But if you have a slight bias to the thing, you cannot rule it. They came to Moshe Rabbeinu, make a ruling about us, what we should do with the inheritance, right? There was no sons. We don't want to lose out. So Moshe Rabbeinu could have made the ruling. The Torah is teaching us, anytime there's an issue, and you have a slight bias, even though if it's far-fetched, far-out bias, like it, and you're Moshe Rabbeinu, don't mix in. Because you're not going to be able to rule properly. You go there many times, you can't take a bribe. And bribe takes very different forms. Flattery takes is a form of bribery. Money is a form of bribery. Whatever it may be. Here the Torah is teaching us, even though there was such a slight bias of Moshe Rabbeinu's part, that they said he wasn't involved in Korach, that's all it was, that was enough for Moshe Rabbeinu to say, you know what? I can't rule on it, I have to ask Hashem. Which the Rebbe says is a very important lesson, how a Jew needs to behave when it comes to making decisions about other things. In fact, halachically, one second, in halach it says, a judge that has any bias whatsoever is not allowed to sit on the case. And the Gemara tells a bunch of cases, the Gemara in Ksubis tells a bunch of very interesting cases. The Gemara says, there was a rabbi that was going on a ship, and the man just gave him his hand to be able to go onto the ship. And later that person came to the rabbi for a din Torah. The rabbi said, I'm sorry, I can't sit on it. Because you helped me walk onto, you just gave me your hand to help me walk onto the boat. I can't sit on this case anymore. Because I'm blinded by bribery. Or the Gemara tells another story. There was a rabbi had a worker, a sharecropper. A sharecropper was the guy that worked on percentages. You know, the owner owned the field, the worker would work in the field, and he would give, in Hebrew it's called an oris. He would get a percentage of the field. And this rabbi, this worker, would always bring the rabbi his food, the rabbi's food, on Friday. One time, he brought it on Thursday. But it was the rabbi's food. It wasn't, it was his stuff. He brought it on Thursday. So he says, why did you bring it to me on Thursday? He said, because I have a din Torah I want you to sit on. And the rabbi said, I can't sit on it. So the Gemara says it was the rabbi's own fruit. It wasn't that he gave him a gift. He brought it a day early. The rabbi said, you know what? I'm disqualified from this thing. Tzlavcha's daughter said to Moshe Rabbeinu, our father was not in the fight of Kairach against you. Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'm sorry, I can't rule on it. He brings it to Hashem to make a ruling. Okay, that's what we're up to now. Pasik Vav. And here it's interesting. It doesn't say Vayedaber Hashem Omeishalemer, which normally it says Vayedaber, which is harsh. Here it says Vayomer, softer, because he's dealing with women. Women, like Rashi says in Chumash, Koseimar Lebeis Yaakov. The difference in Hebrew between Vayomer and Vayedaber, Vayomer is soft, Vayedaber is harsh. So he said to women, you have to speak softly. And he said, what did Hashem say to Moshe Rabbeinu? Kein b'neiv tzalavcha doivris. Yes, tzalavcha's daughters speak properly. And Rashi says in the Medrash, in the Gemara, can you imagine God says to women, not the women, I mean women because the women not men, that what you said is correct? Can you imagine the schus that tzalavcha's daughters had, that Hashem said to them, what you spoke is correct? It's an unbelievable merit that they had. Nothing titen lohem achuzas nachla besecha cheyavim. Give them an inheritance amongst the brothers of their father. Va'avartas nachla savien lohem, and you should give the inheritance of the father to pass over to them. Okay, so basically, and the Torah is going to continue. Basically, the Torah is teaching us a new law of inheritance. If there are sons, the sons inherit. No sons, daughters inherit. And it's going to go through the whole system that we'll send them. We'll discuss it in modern day language also, how it works. But the Torah says, they're right, give them achuzas nachla besecha chayaviyam, vavartas nachla saviyam lohem, and give them the nachla of their father to them. Now, the Israelis in the room should right away ask a question over here. It says, Nosein titein lohem. It should say lohen. Besech achei avihem is masculine. It should say achei avihen. Just like the next word says, nachlas avihen lohen. Right? Give over the nachlas. Why does it say, loshen zachar, when he's speaking to the women? About the women. So the Kli Yakar says an interesting thing. What the Torah is telling us here is an interesting din. That when girls inherit, they become the sons. In other words, the girls are in the place of the sons. So when the Torah is speaking about giving them inheritance, the Torah is teaching them, we're giving them inheritance like boys, like the sons would inherit. And then it says, Vavartim es nachla saviyan lohem, and then you would give it over to them. Okay? Now, the Mefarshim explain over here like this. What is this expression, Vahavarta, okay? The beginning of the pasuk says, "Nosein titein." Give, you should give. Then it says, "Va'avartem es nachlasi levite." The Torah should have said, "Give titein the inheritance to the daughters." Why is the Torah starting off by saying giving it to the girls, and then the Torah says, "Pass over the inheritance to the girls"? Why is it like the Torah is changing its terms? It's a very funny thing. So the Kli Yakar explains. Is like this. When the girls inherit, and as B'nai Salafcha, they're not going to talk about here, they're going to come later in Parshas Mates. Let's analyze this whole thing that's going on over here, and then we'll learn it inside. The Tzlochet had no boys. Okay? So the girls came and say, hey, it's not fair. So Meir Shemayin said, no problem. No boys, the girls inherit. Okay, now, what's the problem with this? When the girls are going to marry into another, they get married, they're going to get married from a man to a different tribe. Right? They're allowed to intermarry tribes, by the way. Las Pelegish Begiva, that story with Binyamin, that's a whole different story. But in Judaism, you can intermarry between tribes. You can even intermarry Ashkenazic, Sephardic, it's all allowed. Huh? No problem. So what happens when the girl gets married? Let's say the girl is like they were from Menashe. They're going to get married to somebody from Yehuda. Who inherits that man? His son. Which tribe does his son belong to? Yehuda. So the girls are going to lose out the inheritance. The tribe is going to lose the inheritance. Right? They're from Menashe. Right? Five girls from Menashe. Mishpuches Menashe ben Yosef. Right? That's what the pasuk says. They're going to marry somebody from Yehuda. So eventually, that inherit, that chelek, that belong, that part that belonged to Menashe, is now going to disappear from Menashe and it's going to go to another tribe. And Taka B'nai Salafchad later came, not B'nai Salafchad, the leaders of the tribe of Menashe came and say, one minute, what's going on here? You're giving it to the girls are going to get married to somebody else from a different tribe, and eventually it's going to go to the other tribe. It's not fair. So Moshe Rabbeinu answered B'nai Salafchad at the end of Parshas Matos, you're right. I mean, he told the leaders of the tribes, B'nai Salafchad can marry whoever they want, but it has to be from their tribe. But that was only a one-time deal, by the way. Because of the Yovel Din, the land always goes back to the original owner. It's always going to go back anyway to the original tribe. The first time was a problem. Because the first time, Yehuda is going to own it. So it's always going to go back to Yehuda. Right? Because when the wife comes in, it goes to the husband. So she's going to own it. I mean, the Yehuda's going to own it. But afterwards, it was not a problem. Therefore, it was only that generation, Rashi says later, Mata, I don't want to jump the gun too much, but in that generation, only they had to marry from their own tribe. But nowadays, it doesn't apply. Even later on in history, if a man died and he only had daughters, they inherited and they were able to marry whoever they wanted, because when Yovel came, it went anyway back to the original owner. So it wasn't a problem. But over here, the Torah is saying like this. Give Tzolofchad's daughters the chelek. Nosim titen lehem. Give them their inheritance. Then it says, Vahavartem es nachlosa levite. Because eventually, it's going to pass over to another tribe. Temporarily, at least. That's why the Torah starts off by saying, give it to them. It's theirs. But then the Torah says, Vahavartem es nachlosa is going to pass over eventually to another tribe when they get married. It's not a big problem because eventually by Yovel it's going to go back to the original owner, but it's temporarily it's going to go from tribe to tribe. That's what the Torah says, the way the Torah says it. Okay? So this is Vayer Hashem Moshe. It's interesting, the commentators don't say this and I don't know why, but it says Vayer Hashem Moshe Lamer softly, because he was speaking to Bnei Salafchad, so he's speaking softly. Then it says, "Val bnei Yisrael tedaber lemer." To the man, you speak now. You know the way it's supposed to be spoken. Ish ki yomos, if a man dies, uvein ein lei, and he has no son, va'avaytem es nachlos to levite. You give it over to the daughter. V'emein lebas. What happens if a guy has no daughter? So he has no son and no daughter. Unisatem es nachlos to liochiv. You give the inheritance to the deceased's brother. We're going to read a bunch of psukim next thing. There's a bunch of difficulties here. What happens if the guy who died has no brothers? So he has no kids and no brothers. He give it to his father's brothers.
To the uncles.
But only from the father's side. One second. What happens if the father has no brothers either? That means he has no sons no daughters, no brothers, no uncles. Unesatem es nachlosa, you give the inheritance l'she'erei hakarev elov, you give it to the relative who is closest to him, mimishpachtei, from his family, v'yadoshei se'il inherited.
His wife is not
sure. One second. This is what he thinks, American lawyer. I know I have a bunch of women, probably more women than men, and I can maybe get stoned. But let me tell you what the book says.
That'll be a first.
Putting the shield up first.
Thank you.
The din is, wives never inherit the husbands. Never. No, but wives don't inherit the husbands. Period. When a husband dies, okay, and there's kids, so in the ksuba obligation, the estate has to support the mother as long as she lives. In other words, she doesn't own the husband's property, but the estate feeds her as long as she's alive.
But suppose that the husband dies and the kids are 5 years old.
The kids inherit.
Yeah, but who's going to...
So Bezdin sets what's called in Gemara expression apotropis, which is
an executor,
a manager that takes care of the estate. And he's responsible.
Yeah, but
if he messes up, he has to pay from his own pocket.
The wife is not taking care of
the wife does not take care of the estate. In Gemara times, in biblical times. But what's interesting over here, if you look in the Pasuk says like this. If there's sons, son gets. If there's no son, daughter gets. If there's no daughter, the guy's brothers get. If there's no brothers, the uncles get. What's with the father?
Yeah.
Pasuk doesn't say anything about the father. So the Gemara says, Gemara in the Bava Basra, when it speaks about all the laws of inheritance, says the father, even though the Torah doesn't say it, but the father gets third in line. In other words, according to the halacha, son first, daughter second, father third, if the father's alive. If there's no father, brothers. If there's no brothers, the uncles get, the father's brothers. But it's only from the husband's family, only from the Sher Aviv. Okay? Only the father's family has the right of inheritance. Now, that is just the din itself. Now, what's interesting is, what happens if a guy left over, and don't forget, in the olden days, people died young. I mean, it was a whole different life than we have today. A man dies, he has a son and a daughter. Okay? The son has a daughter. There's a granddaughter. Okay? Her father dies. Then the grandfather dies. Got it? Mm-hmm. So there's a daughter alive and a granddaughter alive. Got it? Not too hard. Right? Father died. The father has a son and a daughter. The son has a daughter. Then the son dies first. Okay? Then the grandfather dies. Who gets the inheritance? The daughter of the son or the daughter? The daughter of the son gets it. Because she's in the place of her father. If her father was alive, he would get. So now that there's no father, she gets, because she's in place of the father. Now, if she would have a brother, the granddaughter, then obviously the grandson gets. Understand? It doesn't only go, even if the daughter had a son, and the son had a daughter, right? So then, the son's daughter is going to get before the son of the daughter. Because it works in the lineage. The son is the first one. So now there's no son, but the daughter is instead of the son. So it's like the son is alive. So the daughter is going to get it. Okay? This is... Now, there's also a din of because Selofchad was a b'chor, so they got double portion from their father also. That's what he says, Nosen Titein. Double expression, because he was a b'chor, so they got double. Now, how does it work? Just to discuss, I mean, you know, there's a whole pedic called Yeshneichlin above Basta that has like 25-30 blot that has all the laws of inheritance, which is long and complicated, but just a few basic things, so to speak. If there's two sons, let's say, or three, let's make it three sons, yeah? And one of the sons is the firstborn. So the din is the b'chor gets double. Which means, what does this mean in practical language? That if there's three sons and the father dies and one of them is a firstborn, so you divide the property into four. The firstborn gets two and each one gets one. If there's 10 kids and one of them is a b'chor, you divide it into 11. He gets 2/10 and everybody else gets 1/10.
Not anymore, right?
One second. What do you mean, not anymore?
Not today. You can do whatever you want, no?
What do you mean, do whatever you want? You can't take away the Torah law.
You still have to give twice to the poor.
In Hebrew, it's called savlonut. In English, you call patience. In Farsi, I don't know. Osele. Okay, Osele. The Torah says, like, the din is like this. Yerusha is automatic. In other words, like we said many times, the Gemara has an expression, Hatinik miyad sheyotzel la'avir ha'olam. As soon as the baby comes out into the world, Yore Shakol, inherit everything. That means you can have the head of Microsoft, who's a guy, but I'm saying you can have a guy that could be worth 50, 60, 70, 80 billion dollars. Okay? And he has a boy, and the kid is just born into the world, and the father dies. That kid owns a lot of money. I mean, the Torah, I'm saying. So he yashins everything. To take it even another step, the Rishonim write, and this is an interesting concept when you speak about Yerusha by a Jew, when you speak about Torah is Meirosha Kihilas Yaakov, a Yerusha. Eretz Yisrael is a Yerusha. Yerusha, you know, Yerusha, Yitzchok, or whatever it is. According to the Rishonim, is like this. When a kid inherits, let's say there are five kids inheriting, it's not that halachically that each one gets a fifth. Each one gets it all. Because the pasuk says, Tachas in Tilim, Tachas aveisecha yuvanecha. Right, this pasuk in Tilim. In the place of the father is the child. That means, just like the father owed it all, every kid owns it all. The problem is, you can't give five kids everything. So practically speaking, you give each kid a fifth. But technically, they inherit it all. Huh?
Joint tenants.
Joint. Which means, when you say, Torah is Meirosha Kehilas Yaakov, it doesn't mean that there's 600,000 letters in Torah, and there's 600,000 Jews, so each Jew gets a letter. It doesn't mean that. Every Jew inherits the entire Torah. Every child inherits the entire fortune of the father. So practically speaking, you can't give everybody everything, so you divide it up accordingly, that each one gets a part of it. Okay, that's the way it works by Yerusha. But the second the kid is born, you know, there's an interesting argument, just to show a difference. A partnership. You see in Torah, the way Torah looks at different things. Me and you own this table, partners. Yeah? You and me, you and I, and speak correct English. you and I own this table. What does it mean? I have 50% of the table, and you have 50% of the table, or we have the whole table both? Both of us have the whole table. What does it mean?
Both of us have the whole table. You cannot split the table anymore.
Is the right to use?
Is the ownership, is it 50-50, or it's 100-100? 100. So, I'm glad that everybody said their opinion. In Torah, it's an argument between Tosfos and Rashi. It's an argument between Rambam and Rosh. I'll give you a very simple example of this, okay, where you see the difference. I live here, you live here. We're part neighbors. Yep. So we build a wall together. We build a wall together between our houses. The wall is 2 feet wide. Let's say, right? So I paid half the wall, you paid half the wall, right? So we're partners in the wall. The wall is 2 feet wide. One of the partners says, you know what? I want to make the wall higher. And the neighbor says, no, I don't want. I don't want you to make the wall higher. Does this neighbor that wants to make it higher, can he take 1 foot of the width of the wall and make it higher? What's it dependent on? If it's 50-50, so this foot is mine, and this foot is yours. On my foot, I could do whatever I want. So if I want to make it higher, I can make it higher. You can't stop me. But if each one owns every part of the wall, that means this foot is 50% yours and 50% mine. So I can't do, I can't build on your property what you don't want me to build. Instead, so the question is, Rambam and Russian tour, I'm saying not Rambam and Russian, Russian tour, whether you're allowed to build like this, in the yeshiva world, the guys know this. So this is the argument. But by Yerusha, by inheritance, everybody says each one gets 100%. Instead, there's a difference if it's my part, your part, or if it's all together. Okay, that's the halachic difference. So now the question is, how do you sidetrack this? You have a family today, yeah? So can you imagine if the boys get and the girls get nothing?
Boy, boy.
Oy vey. You have a world war.
Boy, boy.
Not an Afghanistan war, a world war.
Boy,
boy. So how do you get around it? What's the, just practically speaking, what's the eitzah to get around it? So if you write a will according to Torah, there's a very simple way of doing it. Let's say, for argument's sake, the estate is $1,000. Okay? And you have 4 kids. Okay? So, 2 boys, 2 girls. And you want everybody to be equal. So how do you do it? Huh? What do you do?
According to Torah?
What's the Torah way of getting the girls to inherit?
So it's like 2 boys, so the first boy is going to get 2.
Double.
And the rest.
It's a good thing you guys didn't write the books.
Divided into 6.
You can't take away inheritance. The Torah says inheritance. If there's a girl, if there's a boy, the girls don't get. Right? That's what the Torah says. So how can you have, if you have daughters, how can you get them to have equally with the boys? So what you do is like this. You write in your will. Now, it's self-understood. Before somebody dies, I can do with my money whatever I want. Okay? I can do with my money whatever I want. See, the way Torah wills are written is like this, basically. I mean, it's complicated, but just in a nutshell, the general concept of it. In the will, it says that 1 minute before I die, $950 of my money is divided equally amongst my kids. So I'm giving away a gift before I die. Now, dead people can't give away gifts. Once you die, it's inheritance. Okay? No, dead people can't give a gift. So you can't say it should be effective after I die, because then it's worthless. Because the second he dies, there's inheritance already. According to Torah, not only civil law, with the taxes and all that junk.
Gift tax.
Yeah, there's no gift tax in Torah. So what you do is, you write in the will, again, let's say the estate is $1,000. So you write in the will that 1 minute before I die, the four kids divide the $950 equally. Okay? But you don't want to nullify the Torah law of inheritance. So you leave over a little bit of money.
$50.
$50. So it could be $10. Doesn't matter. Just concept. You leave over $50. That is inheritance. And that $50, the boys get and not the girl, and the bechor gets double, and that's the way you work it out. That's the way they do it in America. And actually, so they do a different thing afterwards. Besdin makes the son sign over. I think in Israel they do it a little bit differently. But in the way it's done in America legally, because you need it legally for the government laws and all that. So you write a legal will, which based according to Torah, they have forms already to fill these things out. You make it that 950 is gifts to every child equal. But again, you don't want to take away the mitzvah of inheritance. It says you shouldn't do that. So you leave over a few bucks that they do the dinner of inheritance, and that's it. So in that, the boys get a few bucks more than the girls. But in the estate, everybody basically gets the same.
Can you change that?
That's only the son. If somebody doesn't have a son, but they have daughters, so they get equal, or the bechorah gets...
No. There's no bechorah by girls. No. If a guy only has daughters,
yeah,
like Tzlovchot, it was divided five ways equally, not six. There's no bechor by... Because it says, ha-bechor ha-shetele. The Torah speaks about this masculine, about the bechor, the ben. Mm. But the girls, though, there's no dinner bechor by girl. Now what?
So
now it's the world's problems are solved?
One second.
What?
If you wrote a trust or you wrote your will, can you put like some merchandise or some stuff from the house for the boy, or you really should change the whole thing? If you already have your will.
No.
And can you put something for example, a dish or carpet or something for the boy, instead of giving him more money?
No.
It has to be more money.
Has to be the double of that, whatever you're leaving over.
It's an inheritance.
It says in, one second, in the halacha it says, by the way, if somebody, the Gemara talks about what happens, the argument, Rabbi Yechim ben Breik and the Chachamim, can a guy change these laws of the Torah? Can a guy say, I don't want the son to get, I only want the daughter, inheritance.
Yeah.
So you can't do it. And it says, the Gemara also says, that Bechlal, he speaks about inheritance and other things, a person should not give more to one child than the next.
Yes.
Because the Gemara says, look what happened to Yosef and the brothers. Okay. So the Gemara says, you shouldn't do that. But this is the way, basically, it works out, just from a practical point of view, which is goes according to halacha, because before a person dies, they can do whatever they want with their money.
Can you give it to the grandchildren, instead of children?
Could do whatever you want. But you should know the rule. The rule is, where there's a will, there's a relative.
But can you give a money to a charity cause?
You can do it. Before you die, you can do whatever you want with your money.
But the kids,
once you die, you can't do anything.
And what is the fact that the Bechor get double? He has a responsibility. Where is coming from this where? Why?
Originally is because the Bechor would work in the Beis HaMikdash, but even after that stopped, after the Yegel, the Torah says there's a certain Maila of a Bechor. In Ruchnias, there's a Maila of a Bechor.
He's responsible about something?
It's not a question necessarily responsibility. There's certain responsibilities a Bechor has. For instance, if a father died, a brother died without kids, so he has to do Yibum. Okay? So you go to the oldest. Let's see, there's four brothers, yeah? See, one of them has to marry the girl, or else do chalitza. So you go to the older brother first. You want to marry her? No. Go to the next. Then all four say no. Then you go back to the oldest and say, listen, you're the oldest. either marry or chalitza, one of the two. So there's certain responsibilities a b'chor has, halachically. But is that the reason the Torah says? Because he's the firstborn, and Hashem wanted him to be the firstborn. So there's a certain advantage that he has just being a firstborn that God gave him. It wasn't his choice to be first or last. No, but none of us have a choice when to be born. Okay, now, so therefore, like this. Since Torah says, what happens if there's no uncles? You give it l'sheira akarev eloch mimishpachti. You give it to the closest relative.
Could be aunt or just has to be male?
What? No, only male.
Only male.
Yes. Now, it has to be paternal, from the father's side only, because it says mimishpachti. Now, what happens if there's no relatives? So Rashi says in the Gemara, it can't be. Because we all come from Yaakov Avinu, so they got to be all the way up somewhere. There's relatives along the way. There's only one possibility of a Jew dying without relatives. Convert. Anybody know?
Convert.
A ger who never got married, never had kids, correct? When he dies or she dies, huh? There's no relatives. So who gets it? So the Gemara says, a convert with, that has no family, that dies, his properties are what's called hefker free-for-all. First come, first serve.
What does it mean?
Hmm?
What does it mean?
Whoever gets it first, gets it.
The shul gets it.
Well, that's my law, but that's not what
it is.
Yeah.
Is it against halacha to leave things to like a charitable organization if you have relatives?
That has to be given, though, as a gift. Before, if you want to do it correctly according to halacha, yeah, you have to give it as a gift before you die. But you can do it earlier. You can say a minute before I die is when it takes effect. Again, this is the laws of inheritance in a massive nutshell, because the laws are complicated and you know, very difficult. Okay, it has to be mishpat. There should be a decree of justice. Okay? Now, what does it mean, chukas mishpat? What is the Torah saying? So it means over here, the Mefarshim explain that this is not only for this one time deal with B'nai Selofchad. This is a permanent law for all times in the law of inheritance. That's basically the Torah's teaching. This is not a law only to B'nai Selofchad. For all future times, this is the law. Okay? But you can't do things to contradict Torah law and so on and so forth. Now, the Rabbeinu Bachai just adds another interesting thing. Why did the law of inheritance come about through through women? The law of inheritance, why? So we mentioned a different reason. They merited or whatever. Rabbeinu Bachai says another interesting reason why. Because death in the world came about through Chava. She got Adam and Eve to eat from the tree. That's when Hashem decreed death into the world. So the concept of inheritance, of a father dying, came about through women. So the law of inheritance came about through women. That's what Rabbeinu Bachai says. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir. What's you just the, did, by the way.
I know. What's the story with the large consonant? Mishpatan?
Why is there a big nun? Let me see if anybody talks about it, because if they talk about it, good, and if not, nah. See if the Baal Turim says anything here. I don't know. Bechlal, you should know, and there's already in the back of one of the Rambams, it shows, You have three letters in Torah. Big letters, small letters, and the normal letters. In Tanakh, it's interesting to know. In Tanakh, there is a whole set of big letters. In other words, throughout Tanakh, you will see a big Aleph, and a big Beis, and a big Gimel, and a big Dalet, and a big Hay, all the way to Sof. And there's a small entire Aleph Beis throughout Tanakh. Only one. There's only one small Gimel, and one small Dalet, and one big Gimel, and one big Dalet throughout the entire Tanakh. In Kabbalah, there's this big thing about big letters, little letters, average letters, but it's interesting, when you see a big letter, a small letter, it's part of an entire Aleph Beis of big letters or small letters throughout Tanakh. In the Ramam La'om, in back of the Dinam, a Sefer Torah, it just says all the big Alephs and the big Beis and the big Gimel and the little Alephs and the little Beis. Like, for instance, Bereishis Bar Lekim is a big Beis. The first word of Divrei Hayamim, Adam, starts with Adam, is a big Aleph. Vayikra as a little Aleph. Okay, they have the big and the smalls and the middles. There's in Kabbalah a lot is what to do with big letters, bigger revelations, smaller revelations, middle revelations. Letters are basically, we were learning this morning, Chassidus. Letters are basically like stones, which are completely inanimate. They themselves mean nothing, but the formation of the letters are vessels for an idea, intellect, or an emotion to come across. If I want to teach you an intellectual concept, right? So, I have to speak in words. Correct? Now, the letters themselves mean nothing. But when you formulate the letters in a certain pattern, then they mean something. For instance, take the first two letters of the Aleph Beis. Yeah? Aleph Beis is Av, which means father. If you switch it around, Beis Aleph means bull, come. Right? Come and father have nothing to do with each other. Correct? Except when a father says, come to the kids, they say, what do you want? Right? You know what I mean? What? You call the what? Yeah, you know? But, so what is the Aleph and the Beis? Aleph and Beis have nothing to do with the word father. Right? They're vehicles for the sake of a revelation, whether it's an intellectual or emotional. If somebody says, wants to express love, and they say, I love you, or I hate you, or I fear you, okay? The letters F-E-A-R has nothing to do with the word fear, because F can be a different, you know, when you put the letters in a certain form, in any language, whatever it is, right? If you put F-E-A-R, it's fear. If I put L-O-V-E, it's love. That doesn't mean every L has anything to do with love, or O-V-E, when you put them together in a certain form. So what letters basically are vehicles and vessels to reveal things. Right? It's simple to understand. Letters themselves are nothing. When you put the letters in a certain form, shape, size, whatever. Okay. So you can understand that big letters in Torah represent a greater revelation, and small letters represent a smaller revelation. And the middle letters refer to normal revelation. But that's, even though what's unique in Torah, it's not like any other language. Because Torah is Lashon Kodesh. The shape of every letter is significant to the revelation and the meaning of the letter. And the word of the letter has significance. For instance, the letter Aleph, the way the letter Aleph is shaped, and the way the letter Beis is shaped, has to do, not only in Kabbalah, but in books that are written on letters, basically is based in Kabbalah a lot, have to do with the significance of the letter Aleph itself. A has no meaning. Aleph has a meaning. Aleph, the word Aleph, the letter Aleph, when you write it out, is Aleph Lamed Pei. Aleph. How do you write out the letter Aleph? Aleph Lamed Pei. Aleph means to teach. Beis is the concept of bias. Gimel, Dalid, the Gemara says, Gmerl Dalim. Giving Gemilas Chesed to the poor. You understand? So, the letters in Torah, because of Lashon Kodesh, it's not a letter that some people made up a language. There's Lashon Atzmi and Lashon Haskami. In Torah Sfarim it says, all the other languages are called Lashon Haskami. How do you get English? A bunch of people got together and said, these are the words that mean this and this. By Torah it's a Lashon Atzmi. It's not that a bunch of Jews got together and made up Ivrit. Okay? And taka those words in Ivrit, the taka och and vei. But Lashon Kodesh is the formation of the letter. Like if you have an Aleph, like we learned many times, what's the letter Aleph? There's a Yud on top, and there's a Yud at the bottom, with a Vav in the middle. Right? Which represents, number one, Yud and Vav is 26, which is Yud Kei Vav Kei, equals numerical value of Yud Kei Vav Kei is 26. In Ayayim Yayim it says, the Yud from above on top represents Hashem. The Yud at the bottom represents the 10 powers of the Jew. And the Vav, which is the middle, be connecting the two, that has to do with the Vav of Yerushalayim that connects God and the Jew. The fact that a Beis, okay, goes inward, because Lashon Kodesh you go right to left, right? So the letter Beis, correct, is the letter that's closed on three sides, but open on the fourth. Okay. One of the reasons the Torah begins with a Beis, because the Gemara says, Ruch Tzvein Esenu Mesuvevis, the fourth corner of the world, the North Pole, is an unfinished part of the world, and God created the world unfinished, in case a big machab will come and say, big deal, God created the world, so can I. You know, I'm also God. God's going to say, okay, you know what? I left you a corner to finish. Go finish it. So the world's creation begins with a base, because God created the world. Not only that, his base begins Teda, because when a person learns Teda, they have to forget about all the outside stuff. The distractions. So what's a letter Beis? It's closed on all the outside, because Hebrew goes right to left. Where is it open into? Only into the Torah. I mean, you have countless of things. So in Torah, the formation of the letters itself is Kedusha. And you can go on to every letter, Dalid, the difference between Dalid and Reish. The difference between hey and ches, the way a dalet becomes a hey and a resh becomes a kuf. You have, if I could talk now for half an hour just on the letters dalet and resh.
They are all connected because each letter is part of the other letter, no?
Okay, dalet and Reish, they look alike. They look alike, yeah? Not only do they look alike, they mean alike. What does Dalid mean? Dal, poor. What does Reish mean?
Poor.
Rosh. L'rosh enko, not with an aleph. Reishin means Rosh. But ani v'rosh, all over Tanakh. Yeah? Rosh is poor. So a Dalid is poor, means poor, and a Reish means poor. So they look alike. And they mean alike.
They don't look alike. You're missing one vav.
One second. No, Dalid. The only difference between a Dalid and a Reish is on the top right, which is the beginning of the letter, the Dalid has an extension, and the Reish is round. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, that extension is a Yud. What's it? What, in Hebrew, a Dad is a Yud.
Both of them.
Oh, no, the resh is round. The resh doesn't have it. Resh is round. There's no sticking up on the top, right? Because again, Hebrew goes right to left, so you're starting this way.
So, it's yud.
So a dalet has a the beginning is a yud, And then you have the Dalet. Yud symbolizes bittul, humility. Therefore, Dalet is poverty, but it's bittul poverty. Like David HaMelech says, Ki ani ve'evyon ani. David HaMelech says, I'm a poor man. He was very rich. He means he felt with bittul, with humility. Yeah? Therefore, look at this now, this is remarkable. Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And if God forbid you put a resh instead of the Dalet, it's Hashem Acher. Right? It says, Lo sishtachaveh lekel acher. Don't bow to another God. If by mistake you put a resh into a Dalet, God forbid, it says, don't bow to kel echad. Okay? So obviously the Dalet is Kedusha, and the Reish is evil. Yeah. Therefore, from the Dalet in Hebrew, how do you write a hey? You make a Dalet, and then you put the third leg. Okay? That hey is a letter of Kedusha, God's name. A rei, how do you write a kuf? You make a resh, and then a line, but the line goes below the line. There's a part that says, Ragleha yordeis mavis. The feet go down into death. Okay? So Chassidus explains like this. The Dalet represents machshava, thought, dibur, speech, and the hay is action. But that's all in Kedusha. But a resh from bad thought and bad speech, then how do you make a kuf? You go below the line, which symbolizes it goes in dred, into the offer, into the ground. That refers to thought, speech, and action of evil. Instead, so each letter, we got way off topic, but each letter in the Aleph Beis is different. It's not only vehicles and vessels to give over midos or seichel, right? But it actually, each letter, because it's a holy language, each letter has its own unique significance, but first of what it means, and what it, the way it's shaped, and what it looks like, and that's it. It's a much different story.
But you started out by saying that a lot of them, at least I would assume on a shot level, have emotional content. Vayikra, the small Aleph.
Shows his humility.
Yeah, exactly. His
right.
Mokta in Korbanos shows you have to offer it with a fire.
Well, okay, so sometimes in Mepharshim explain what the purpose is. But there is a whole Aleph Beis of small letters, a whole Aleph Beis of big letters, and millions of Aleph Beis of regular letters. Okay, let's just start. Well, let's just start the next pasuk, next page. 888. Yem Hashem Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Alei al har arvarim hazeh. Okay, go up to the mountain har arvarim. Oreis haaretz, and look at the land. Asher nesati levnei Yisrael, which I'm giving to the Jewish people. We're very brief. We're going to start again this next week, but. What's the connection between this and B'nai Salaf Chod story, inheritance? Yeah. There's a connection. Yeah, Moshe Rabbeinu said to God, are you talking about inheritance? Maybe you changed your mind. Maybe I can go into Eretz Yisrael. Maybe I can also get inheritance. You're talking about inheritance. Maybe I can get. So is that Rashi says, Kivin Shama Kosh Baruch Nasi, Shem Hutra Gzeira Veikonis La'aretz. Maybe the Gzeira was nullified in the Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm not changing my mind. You're not going to go up and look at the land. But you're not going anywhere. Don't hold your breath. Because it ain't happened. But there's an interesting krayok over here. The mountain Moshe Rabbeinu really went up to was Har Nevei. Why does he call it here Alei Har Arho Avarim? It's called Har Nevei. Why is he calling it? So the Kleyaka says a beautiful thing. He says, Vavartim Esnachlosa Levitik. We're going to soon learn, not today. Moshe Rabbeinu says to God, okay, now that you're telling me to die, maybe my kids will can take over the leadership. So Hashem said, no, they ain't doing it. You're giving it over to Yeshua. So the expression ahavara, passing over, means Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm passing over your kids to take over your position, and I'm passing them over and I'm giving it to Yeshua. So basically Hashem is using the word va'avartem to teach that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted his kids to take over after he died, and Hashem said, no, Yeshua ben Nun is taking over. Because he's fit for the job, and your kids aren't. Moshe Rabbeinu tried. Didn't go. Okay.